Good morning. I'd like to thank Leo Hansen for his wonderful music this morning. Leo, a couple of years ago, was doing this for us and for himself, playing shakuhachi. And shakuhachi originated in Zen monasteries, didn't it?
Right. Leo? It was practiced by Zen monks called Komuso, which meant priest of nothingness. And they would travel around and play this music. And they would practice what is called Zui Zen, as opposed to Zazen, which is seated meditation. Zui Zen is blowing meditation.
Blowing.
And at one time in Japan, there were approximately 120 temples that were devoted to the Komuso and their practice of, I guess, enlightenment through their music. And they would travel around for beg for alms for their temples and bring faithful a reminder of the nature of the Buddha.
Wow. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you for allowing me to play. It's an honor and a privilege to play for you.
We are honored. Mm-hmm. Thanks. Oh, everyone should be well rested, right? Should have an extra hour of sleep today, last night. You did, I didn't. So this morning I want to continue to talk about trust in mind, faith in mind. The poems are kind of a theme, I guess, on Sundays lately. The poem by Sengsan, the third ancestor of Zen, Chinese Zen. There's some doubt as to whether Sengsan really existed. But that's okay, because his poem is really great. It's really it's in the spirit of the Buddha's teaching of offering medicine to cure our ill. So I'll read it. It's really long. I was going to print it out and hand it out to all, but decided that it was just too long, and I'm not even going to read the whole thing. I'm going to read the first page so that, and hopefully, you know, last time I talked on this, I got through the title, the author, and the first line. This time, I intend to get through 10 lines, so we'll see. We'll see. So I'll read it. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. The way is perfect, like vast space, where nothing is lacking and nothing is in excess. Indeed, it's due to our choosing to accept or reject that we don't see the true nature of things. Live neither in the entanglements of outer things nor in inner feelings of emptiness. Be serene in the oneness of things, and such erroneous views will disappear by themselves. Now that sounds like another sutra that we chant, doesn't it? It sounds like the end of Fukan's Zenki to me. This stuff all sounds alike after a while. So just a brief background on Sengsan, at least the legend of Sengsan, the third ancestor. He was the first three ancestors of Zen, for those of you who don't know, are Bodhidharma and his student Wiko and Sengsan. Sengsan was said to have been a lay practitioner, and he had leprosy. And he was said to have been cured when he was enlightened under Wiko. So now he's offering us his cure, the cure to dukkha, suffering. So why don't I just start, because I have a lot to get through here. So ambitious today. The first line, the mind of the great way, refers to the mind that's in harmony with nature. It's a Taoist conception that the Tao is synonymous with Dharma. This poem was written in pre-Chan Buddhist time, supposedly. And so it comes right out of the 200-year period where the Chinese were assimilating Indian Buddhist concepts. And they were synthesizing. The Chinese were great synthesizers. So they were taking what they could use that fit their culture, because they called the Indians the barbarians, you know. So they themselves had the highest culture that existed, so what need did they have? But they did appreciate it, and I think it's because, scholars think it's because, Confucianism just wasn't working for people so well. The Han Dynasty was falling, and there was violence and chaos, and the exquisite rules for order that Confucianism involved just didn't seem to fit for people. And they appreciated the focus on the individual that Taoism and Buddhism offered. So this poem is pre-Chan Buddhism. He's considered the third ancestor, but it's pre-Chan, so there's a lot of Taoist elements in this. So the way for Taoists is the mind that's in harmony with nature, and the mind that's pristine and clear and bright, and where there's no self-consciousness. So, and within this, all change and transformation can take place without any struggle. Within this mind, this mind of the Great Way. And the Great Way, of course, is the Dharma, or the path, or the Tao. It's the path that we walk with no designs on becoming a Buddha. Let's see. So this path obviously involves some effort. There is this sense of effort, no effort. No efforting within effort. We have to make an effort. And it's really helpful to have some discipline. And I think that what we've gotten from these forest ascetics and these hermits of the Chinese hermit tradition and Taoists is the ability to create our own discipline and practice. I think that if you hang around Zen Center for a while, you'll sort of sense, maybe after years of practice, that we ourselves here are trying to synthesize this kind of independent self-discipline practice along with group practice. Which we inherited from the Japanese monastic system, the Chinese and then the Japanese monastic system. So for me, this path is one of, has been one of healing and just an incredible discovery and growth. And although it's hard, it's a hard path, it's a hard path to walk, it's so vivid and so alive. And I remember Katagiri saying so many times, to live is just to live. And I really appreciate that. I appreciate that more and more as I get older. To live is just to live. It's not for some purpose. It's not for some gain. It's not for wealth. It's not for... To live is not for something else. To live is just this great gift that we have. To live is just to live. So the next part of this, the great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. I'm thinking, you know, since this is possibly one of the genre of enlightenment poems, that it wasn't difficult for Singh-san written from that perspective, but for the rest of us, it might be a little difficult not to pick and choose, because we're always picking and choosing. But I think that, you know, the folks that are here today that are in practice period might tell you that making a commitment is a way of not picking and choosing. You know, just making a commitment to sit at a regular time and doing that and letting go of, should I do it now? Should I do it here? Should I do it there? It allows a deep settling to happen. And it allows then for us to see where that preferencing keeps coming up, you know. Because we've simplified our experience to the point where we just begin to notice this, like and dislike stuff. I like this, I don't like that. I like this, I don't like that. Most of the time we're unconscious of it. But when we begin to practice and to settle down, then we become very conscious of it. We see how it's always running, like it's a program running. Dokai was saying a couple weeks ago that he thought it all boiled down to, I like this, I don't like that. I like this, I don't like that. So, but Sang-san is saying, letting go of the preferencing mind, is the way to experience, to enter, to be within the mind of the Great Way. So next line, we're moving right along here. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. So that Sing-san's telling us very clearly that if we do this practice of sitting down and letting go of preference and watching the mind of preference, that we will be able at some point to live life as a completely fresh unit of perception, each thought, that will be possible for us. Rather than living life and seeing life and perceiving through this distorting lens of underlying network that's created from our preferences. It might take us a long time, but we can do it. So I have to tell you that I appreciate studying this, because I really need this myself. I really need this to study the mind of not picking and choosing. And it's great when you have to give a talk, because then you have to study. You have to read and study and practice it. Insight into the workings of emptiness or shunyata is part of this. It's an important ingredient in this learning how to not pick and choose. To have the insight that we are not something separate and something discrete and something lasting and something solid really aids this practice. Practice of sitting meditation and of not picking and choosing. We need that insight. And then when we have that insight and we sit down, we can experience love and hate and like and dislike as just an energy, an underlying energy. We can work with it as energy, so we don't get involved in fighting with it in a struggle. So if we know there's no solid being called Susan or Jeff or Stacy, then we can learn how to not make a story out of what comes up in Zazen and daily life, although it's easier to see in Zazen. So positively stated in the Taoist sensibility, letting go of separateness means embracing all things. It's not something nihilistic, not something bleak or drab. Next line. If you wish to see the truth, hold no opinions for or against anything. I love that line, if you wish to see the truth, because it's not religious, it's not dogmatic, it's just simply anybody can do this. If you wish to see the truth, hold no opinions. And that involves deconstruction of our conditioning. And most people don't want to do deconstruction because they're worried that it's going to destroy their identity, their sense of agency of who they are in this world. And it's not like that. It's not necessary to do that. Our identity is an important social construct. We can keep our identity. The only thing that we're deconstructing with this is the afflictions, is the tendencies, the patterns. And those things just hold us in bondage. And that doesn't mean ignoring ethics or morality either. Morality and ethics are the underpinning of the Great Way. Next line, to set up what you like against what you don't like is the disease of the mind. Disease of the mind is simply the constant internal chatter that is the wallpaper of our minds. It's just always there, this chatter, and it prevents us from entering stillness. It's just constantly going, and when you first start to do meditation, if you're new to meditation practice, you can feel like things are just getting much worse. You're sitting there and you feel like maybe you were crazy all along and you just weren't aware of it. But it will get better for those of you who are having that experience. It will get better. There'll be glimpses of peace, glimpses of openness, and even serenity that will come. And then maybe gradually you can piece those together and come to appreciate what happens when you sit down. And still the chatter. Next line. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential stillness is disturbed to no avail. The deep meaning referred to here is that things don't have an own being. That things are not, that things and us are essentially empty. That's the deep meaning. And our internal chatter is fueled by this unexamined belief that things are solid and that we're solid. And that's a big problem for us. Because it's not that things aren't real. It's that our idea of those things is what's not real. And that's what confuses us. So this deep meaning, and then we become ready and willing to fight for our idea of whatever it is that we immediately invest in and believe in, then we're willing to fight for it. So if you ever find that happening to you, just stop. Just try to stop. Just try to sit down. So deep meaning is seen through the lens of emptiness, shunyata. The way is perfect, like vast space where nothing is hidden. When the geese fly south in the autumn, They don't leave any traces in the sky. They don't leave any footprints. And that's what this is like. We often feel incomplete, and we feel like something's lacking. We feel empty inside, like there's a hole there, so we're always trying to fill it up, fill it up, fill it up. Fill it up with knowledge, with material things, with wealth, with great Zen things. there's no end, and no end to the subtlety of how we can attempt to fill this sense of incompleteness up. So Sengsan's advice for us is, in non-doing, in non-efforting, is not to get caught up in a struggle. Not to get caught up in a struggle, because the struggle will mire us even deeper. You know, when we see that we're doing that, when we see that we're appropriating things to fill up our internal holes, we can want to stop that. We want to get rid of it, and we come up with a strategy. But the strategies themselves are help to get us further mired. So the idea is to let go of all strategies. And if you get really confused, go and talk to Tim Burkett or someone else. That might help you just get free or just get a little space if doing this on your own seems too daunting. But we can all appreciate how, when we don't impose our will on the situation, how we can sit back and watch things unfold. We can watch the nature of a goose being a goose by flying south. And we have a nature. And we can get into touch with our own nature through sitting and through just living. So fretting about all of this is also empty. Fretting about all these problems, all these issues, all these patterns is also empty. You can remember that. Indeed, it's due to our choosing to accept or reject that we don't see... Didn't I read that one already? No, I didn't. Did I? Did I just read that? Did you? Are you guys paying attention? Because I didn't read that. Okay, because I need your help. Oh, did I say Ben? Yeah, I think I got out of order, so I just did the last one that I was going to do. Indeed, it's due to our choosing to accept or reject that we don't see the true nature of things. I talked about the true nature of things, the deep meaning of things, being empty. But we have a choice to accept or reject. To say, I like, I don't like. We actually have a choice, but we really don't usually notice that moment just before we have the choice. And that's the benefit of practice, is that we develop the ability to catch ourselves, to see where the moment of choice is before we go off down that mind road of like and dislike, and pretty soon we're lost in confusion. That's that hair's breadth deviation. You notice this. You can notice this when, if you do retreats, some of you do retreats, some of you do sesshins, and if you start to move, sometimes that leads to a whole lot more moving. you just let yourself go there, and then you just find that, oh, you're just moving and moving and moving. You might spend a whole sitting doing that, thinking, oh, that poor person sitting next to me. Oh, the mind is like that. The mind is like that. When we make that choice to go there, down that road with the picking and choosing, then it pretty much just proliferates, and then we're kind of lost for a little while. But we can always come back. We can always come back. So, but our big problem is that we get caught up in our reactivity. And then we lose our equanimity when we're caught up in that. And doing the like and the dislike thing, that feeds reactivity. So instead of just looking outside and saying, oh, fall is here and winter's on its way and it's already cold and I don't like this and why do I live here and that wind is awful today, we can just embrace it and allow the wind to blow us and see what that feels like. Allow the cold to penetrate into our bones and see what that feels like, because that's being really alive. Live neither in the entanglements of things nor in inner feelings of emptiness. That's a big challenge, because to live in the world yet not be of it. Because we live in a 24/7 world of information, everything's going really, really fast. And to step off that is, that's where our discipline comes in. That takes strength, inner strength, to step off the merry-go-round of modern life. And our inner feelings of emptiness, I think, in this time are of boredom. Boredom and discontent. Feeling like there's something lacking. We're not quite right. We don't measure up somehow. We're comparing ourselves with someone else. Those are all... I'm not talking about seeing emptiness, shunyata now. I'm talking about the sense of lack that we have and of boredom and life being a bit flat, and it's just not quite right, you know, when we feel like that. Some of the Tibetan teachers who've come over here, including the Dalai Lama, have been amazed to realize how we suffer through our emotional patterning as Westerners, and also this sense of lack of purpose and boredom. Because we have so many things and we have so much and there's so many choices that it actually leads to a kind of deadness if we're not careful. So we have to keep it alive. We have to keep it alive, folks. Keep it going. Keep it fresh. Yes, I already talked about this last point. You try to stop activity to achieve passivity. Your very effort fills you with activity. So I talked about the strategies that sometimes just make us all the more busy. There's a quote that speaks to this. Stop moving to become still, and the stillness will move. So even when we sit down to do meditation, that's a very dynamic activity. And in that stillness, there is movement. It's very subtle. It's not some kind of escape or quietude. That stillness has a lot of dynamism in it. I think I'd like to end with this poem that's on your program by Layman Pang. Oh, I just want to also say one more thing, and that is that the sentiments, the Taoist, Budo-Taoist sentiments in this poem are also reflected in the encounters between these iconoclastic, crazy Zen masters that were studying in practice period. So that's another reason why scholars wonder about this, about the timeline here, because those Zen masters, Master Man, Shitu, and Layman Ping all lived in the Tang Dynasty, the so-called Golden Age of Zen. I didn't know this, but my new best friend, Wu Soing, who wrote this book, he's actually the resident scholar at the Bar Massachusetts. I don't know what it's called.
Insight Meditation Society.
The Insight Meditation Society, right? He's the resident scholar, and he wrote this book, and he's actually a scholar of the Mahayana. He talks about how these Zen masters that we're reading now are quite a departure from the first three, from Bodhidharma and Wiko and Sengsan, in that mainly in that with those first three ancestors, the transmission of the bowl and the robe was so important, whereas these guys in the Tang Dynasty are all about forget bowls, ropes, none of this. It's just mind to mind. Mind to mind. So, along those lines, I will end with this poem that's on the front of your program, unless one of you wants to read it, and that would be fine with me too. Hear from somebody else. My daily affairs are quite ordinary, but I'm in total harmony with them. I don't hold on to anything, don't reject anything. Nowhere an obstacle or conflict. Who cares about wealth and honor? Even the poorest thing shines. My miraculous power and spiritual activity, drawing water and carrying wood. So we've been all over China today. And we're right back where we started from, by the shores of Lake Calhoun together. So I don't think that I will ever get through probably this whole poem. But that's okay. Because it keeps sort of restating and circling around. First looking at it this way, then looking at it that way. So do you have any comments or questions, or you want to sing or something? We had music, now we can tell a joke. A Zen joke. A Taoist joke?
I've got a Zen joke.
Okay.
Well, it's not really a joke. It's actually the, you don't know this, it's the 400th anniversary of the famous koan concerning a dog and its nature. And
Chow Chow.
A little historical background. Before 1600, in Japan, it was in turmoil. Wars, all these clans were fighting each other, trying to get control. And 1600, there was the Battle of Sekigahara, which was won by the Tokugawa clan. And that united Japan, and it installed Ieyasu Tokugawa as the shogun. And his shogun, it lasted from 1603 until, I think it's 1868. That was 250 years of peace, and all these clans weren't fighting anymore. So they turn their interest to other endeavors. The Tokugawa clan was famous for their agriculture advances, specifically their maple syrup. They were very good at making maple syrup, and they have these specially trained dogs that could sniff the trees that had the most sap, the maple trees that had the most sap in them. So this is where the koan comes in. Master and a student were walking through the woods, and they saw this, the Tokugawa clan, with their dog sniffing these trees. And the student said to the master, "Master, what kind of dog is that?" And the master said, and here's where the student was enlightened. The master said, "That is the hound of one clan sapping."
Oh, no.
And that's what they call a shaggy dog story.
The hound of one clan sapping. Okay.
That's what they call a shaggy dog story.
Thanks, Leo. They're all true stories, you know.
You said that we can keep our identity. Keep my question. What is that?
Well, basically, our social identity, I'm talking about the relative level, not the absolute here, right? Mm-hmm. So, Susan is still Susan, who lives on Colfax, married to Dwayne, and I won't say more, I'm embarrassed. But that still exists, and yet it's empty, you know. So it just means, I think some people misunderstand, they think that we, in deconstructing, we mean to tear ourselves or them down or something. It's not true, so that was what I meant.
See, furthermore, with Halloween last night, which suggests identity is a kind of a grumpy costume.
Yeah.
You gotta do two things. You gotta remember to put it on, and you gotta remember to take it off.
That's right. Thanks. Do you have something, Matt?
I was gonna say something very similar.
Oh.
I was gonna say that, you know, like the shirt is empty. That doesn't mean it doesn't keep me warm. You know,
right.
I can wear it.
Mm-hmm. It has a function, right? And that's what the Chinese were so, that was their, well, that was their rebellion of Chinese Zen, is that it was very functional. It was rebelling against the theoretical nature of Indian Zen.
Just because your shirt keeps you warm doesn't mean you should think that you are the band that's on it.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a teaching about inactivity. When it's time to fly south, fly south. When it's time to fly north, fly north.
Right.
But you have a choice. Don't make it.
I don't know about that, but I wish I could fly south.
Heaven and earth are rent asunder.
Rent definitely rent asunder.
A oneness line is when you come to a fork in a road, take it.
say that again.
It's a oneness teaching.
When you come to a
fork in a road, take it.
Thought that was Yogi Bear.
It is Yogi Bear.
Okay, no more jokes? Please, no more jokes. Okay, well, thanks so much.